Tree canopies, road names, city rivalries. Which listener-submitted topic do you want us to report on for our next FAQ City podcast? Cast your vote and contribute your own question right now on WFAE.org/FAQ City.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. Some observers have labeled this year's elections the Year of the Woman, based on the number of female candidates seeking public office. According to NBC News, in the states that have held primaries so far, 72 female candidates in 66 U.S. House districts have secured their party's nominations for this fall's general election, with some races in the fall being contested by two women representing both parties. That number of female candidates, 72, is a staggering increase when compared to the last two elections, 41 in 2016 and 36 in 2014, the last midterm election. But what do women face in terms of the obstacles when on the campaign trail? Why haven't more women been elected to public office when females make up only 20% of the members of Congress, 12% are governors, and less than 22% are mayors? And once elected, how do women shape the discussion of public policies and issues? Joining us for a discussion on the role of women in 2018's politics are a panel of scholars and experts. Via Skype from Rutgers University at Camden is Dr. Kelly Dittmar, an assistant professor of political science and scholar at the Center for American Women in Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. She has authored the book Navigating Gendered Terrain, Stereotypes and Strategy in Statewide Races, and has co-authored the forthcoming book, A Seat at the Table, Congresswomen's Perspectives on Why Their Presence Matters, and her research is on how gender informs campaigns and the impact of gender diversity among elites in policy and politics. Good morning, Kelly.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Joining us in studio here is Dr. Karen Kodrowski, a professor of political science at Winthrop University, where she is executive director of the Center for Civic Learning and co-director of the John C. West Forum on Politics and Policy, where her specialization is on media, women and politics, and public policy. Welcome back to Charlotte Talks, Karen.
Thank you, Michael.
Also with us is Dr. Melody Crowder-Meyer, who is an assistant professor of political science at Davidson College, where she conducts research on how voters respond to candidates with diverse identities such as race, gender, and ethnicity, and how women's political representation is influenced in our politics, especially when it comes to fundraising and the differences between the two parties and their female candidates. Good morning, Melody.
Happy to be here.
And joining us is Dr. Jason Wendett, an associate professor of political science and public administration at UNC Charlotte, where he studies and has published on state politics, especially on gender representation in American state politics. His research on gubernatorial female candidates and their campaigns earned him the award for best dissertation in state politics by the American Political Science Association. Welcome to Charlotte Talks, Jason.
Good morning.
We'd love to hear from you. What do you think will be the impact of women in the 2018 elections? Do female candidates bring a different voice to our political dialogue? If you'd like to join our conversation on the role of women in this year's election cycle and in American politics, send us an email to Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org. You can find us on Facebook, where we are streaming live, or you can send us a tweet at Charlotte Talks. And I want to start this hour's conversation with a general sense of what each of you are seeing. And Kelly, I'll ask you to begin our conversation. In this year's dynamics with the entry of so many women, particularly into the U.S. House races, what does this say about the state of women in our politics?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's an important moment to mark in terms of women's willingness to translate what has been activism and energy and engagement in politics from a sort of outside activity, you know, protesting, engaging in your community and doing other sorts of work that influences public policy, to translating that into candidacy. And that's been a challenge for those of us who work in this space, to make the case to women that running for office and serving in elected office is worthwhile. You know, it's worth the costs of running, the literal costs, as well as the challenges that might be presented to them along the way. And I think what you're seeing this year is a sense of urgency, particularly among progressive Democratic women who looked at the last election and looked at the shift in the nation's politics to the right and said, we need to sort of make sure our voices are heard, not only from the outside in, but that we're sitting at that table. And I think that's a positive move. Because it means that we expand the pool of potential candidates, not just in this cycle where a lot of them are going to be running in sort of uphill battles, but that we keep building that pool so that when the opportunities arise in 2020 and 2022 after redistricting, we've got that bench of women ready to run and ready to fill those seats that become open.
Karen, how do you see things playing out this year?
Well, I agree with everything that Kelly said. First of all, I also see that a lot of women are running in seats where they are, in fact, competitive, and they are continuing to do what a lot of their predecessors have done, which is to poise themselves as outsiders. Even when they might have political resumes of their own, they still fashion themselves as outsiders, which really harkens to how voters see women candidates. They tend to see women candidates as being from the outside, less corruptible and corrupted, and that actually helps give them a leg up in elections.
So, Melody, is this really the year of the outside woman taking on the political environment?
Well, I think that somewhat remains to be seen. One of the things that has stood out, maybe not as much in the media coverage, but I think in sort of observing the details of who's running and how these elections are going, is that we are seeing more women running, but we're also seeing similar patterns to what we've seen in the past. The women who are running are still coming from sort of qualified backgrounds, maybe not always the same exact traditional backgrounds that candidates have come from typically, but they're coming with experience working in government, with experience working in a variety of fields that are very relevant to politics. And so they're very well equipped and sort of highly qualified to seek these offices. We're also seeing similar patterns in the partisanship of the women who are running. So it is not the case that this is necessarily the year of all women, but we're seeing particularly sort of Democratic women disproportionately seeking office in ways that are fairly similar to previous elections, just in somewhat higher numbers this time.
Okay. Jason, how do you see things playing out?
I see this as a sort of a third great awakening of women running for office. That if you look historically, we've had a few waves where women have increased. You saw in the early 70s after activism in the women's rights movement. We saw it again in 1992 with the Year of the Woman. Mm-hmm. And now we're seeing it again this year, where each of those have been sort of encouraged by external events with Clarence Thomas or now with President Trump. And I think this has really been the nudge to get individuals to go from the private office to running for public office.
So you mentioned 1992 as kind of the year of the mm-hmm. woman. That was coming on the heels of the Clarence Thomas,
correct,
Anita Hill hearings. Is there any similarity between that year and this year that we're seeing, or is it still too early to really kind of tell what the dynamics are going to be?
I think that the sexual harassment really resonates with women when they run, when they enter. And we saw this in 91. After the Clarence Thomas hearing, sexual harassment claims skyrocketed. A lot of women didn't know what sexual harassment was or that it could be pursued. Now we're starting to see this with the Me Too movement, where we're going back now almost decades in some instances where people are now saying this is something that happened to me that could encourage folks to run for office to change that.
Melody, do you see this kind of interest in the Me Too movement? Is that what's spurring this rise of female candidates across the country?
Well, I think there's a lot to be said about this path from activism and action in marches and other sorts of political activities that people are engaging in and how that is leading them to candidacy. One of the things we know about especially women candidates, although this is a broadly applies as well, is that people like to be recruited in order to run. And especially women are much more likely to run if they are asked to do so. I have some research that shows that among sort of non-elite women, maybe ordinary women coming from less typical backgrounds, encouragement from personal sources is especially important. And so I think that as we have women joining these Facebook groups, as we have women going to marches, they are engaging much more often, much more frequently with other women, especially in political activity, which puts them in spaces where they might be encouraged to run in a way that they haven't been before. And so if you're having a conversation with your friend about what a prosecutor did and whether they are taking appropriate action about sexual harassment or about writing letters to your members of Congress about an issue you care about, it's much more likely that you might then in that conversation say, well, what's the next thing we could do? You should run. And we know that that appeal, that sort of effort to recruit, is particularly essential in getting women to run. And so I think that boost in numbers may well be coming some from that as well.
Karen.
Another commonality between 1992 and 2018 is the number of retirements from the U.S. Mm-hmm. House of Representatives. Okay. And in 2018, especially, I think this is being fueled by the redistricting cases that are happening, especially in Pennsylvania, where heavily gerrymandered districts are now becoming more competitive. But it's also fueled by Me Too. Right. A number of these retirements have come as there have been revelations about sexual harassment scandals within House offices. And a second thing that I think is different is that there are now a half dozen or more independent programs that are put in place to train women to get ready to run for public office. Some of them are partisan, some of them are nonpartisan, but there are more and more women going into these programs, such as Ready to Run, which Kelly's organization sponsors and disseminates across the country. Some of them are partisan, like Emerge, which is done by the Democratic Party. But all of them, that means that there are more women going into these programs, and then they are ready to run for office because they have gone through these trainings. So they're mentally prepared to do it when the opportunities present themselves.
Kelly, with the work that you do at the Center for American Women in Politics, give us kind of a broad national perspective about the numbers of female candidates. Are they across the board in the various states, or are there pockets of them in particular states that we should be noted about going forward?
I think it is that the trend in terms of the increase of Democratic women running is happening across states. This is a trend that we've been seeing. It's, even if you start to get down, and we don't keep these numbers until the state legislative numbers until they get through the primary, but we're obviously observing those trends as well happening. So it does seem to be pretty broad in terms of the trend and increase of Democratic women's candidacy this time around. But I do think it's really important to recognize the different dynamics in each state. And so one thing that I've noticed this cycle is the tendency, especially in media, to try to tell one story about why women are running, who they are, and how well they're going to do. And I think this ties into this narrative about a year of the woman. It's you know, catchy to say, well, this is the one year and this is why they're running and they're all motivated. But in reality, there's a real diversity of women running. They're running for a variety of reasons, and they're running in very different states and districts. And what that means is that the outcomes from both the primaries and especially in the general election are going to be different from state to state. So you can just look at the last couple of primaries to get a sense of this. So you went from a state like North Carolina or Ohio, where the women who won, who were successful, are going to face really tough races in the fall because they're running in very Republican districts. So yes, women won their primaries. Yes, they're nominees, and that's great. But it's going to be difficult for them to be successful and gain seats in November. We saw this as well in Illinois. If you look, however, at last week at or 2 weeks ago now, in Pennsylvania, the story's a little bit different, right? Because the dynamics in Pennsylvania, where we had a new map drawn, create opportunities for women. So I think while there is this general trend of seeing an increase in candidacy, both among Democratic men and women, I should add, the differences by state are really important to note in terms of whether or not we'll see those candidacies translate into new seats for women come November and January.
Okay. That was Kelly Dittmar at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University. We're talking about the role of women in this year's elections, and we'll come back. This is Charlotte Talks.
On May 31st, WFAE will launch a new investigative podcast called She Says, about one sexual assault survivor's search for justice and healing. Hear a preview now on WFAE.org/She Says.
And welcome back to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE in Hickory. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. And we're talking about 2018 and the Year of the Woman in our national, state, and even local politics with Dr. Melody Crowder-Meyer of Davidson College, Dr. Jason Wendett of UNC Charlotte, Dr. Kelly Dittmar of the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University, and Dr. Karen Kodrowski of Winthrop University. Please join in on our conversation. Send us an email to charlottetalks@wfae.org. You can find us on Facebook where we're streaming, or send us a tweet at Charlotte Talks. And we were talking about the national dynamics with Kelly. Jason and Melody, I want to talk about here in North Carolina. Less than a quarter of the 170 seats in the state legislature are currently held by women, and two of the 13 U.S. representatives are women, one of them being Democrat Alma Adams from here in Charlotte, and Republican Virginia Fox in the 5th District. According to the numbers from the Center for American Women in Politics, 97 female candidates are running for the North Carolina General Assembly's 170 seats. Two-thirds of them are Democrats. Jason, start us off. Talk about what does this say about North Carolina's politics when so many women are invested in and certainly contesting in the General Assembly and in also the U.S. House, Kathy Manning in the 13th Congressional District, Linda Coleman in the 2nd.
I think what this is saying is that North Carolina is getting back to its historical roots as being pro-woman. We've had multiple women female senators. We had a female governor, lieutenant governor, but then that went away after the 2010 backlash elections. I think at this point, we had a six-year period where women weren't running because the opportunity didn't look good after redistricting and the Republican Party taking over the legislature. But now they're looking at Cooper wins statewide. Some of these districts are being redrawn by the courts, and these opportunities are increasing. And they also look at it, I think, at the national politics and implications North Carolina has, that North Carolina has an important role. They can help with that role.
Interesting. Melody?
Yeah, I think that it's been fascinating to see how female candidates have been running in North Carolina this season. In the district where I live, in Davidson, we had a female candidate seeking state legislative office and in the Democratic primary, and we got a lot of mailers from her. She clearly had some good mail designers there. But these mailers were positioning her as a woman, running as a woman. So the first mailer we got had a picture of her, giant picture with her five children, a picture of her holding a sign about her role as a mother, all of these sort of indicators of her womanness, which is not necessarily a typical way for female candidates to campaign. In a lot of cases, you see women trying to emphasize the characteristics we don't stereotypically think that they are good at. So not necessarily talking about their children, but talking about their toughness and their fight and things like that. And certainly she did talk about those sorts of things in these mailers, but she also very clearly was referencing her status as a woman. And I think that's something that makes this a very interesting election. And I'm really curious to see whether this will continue to unfold in future elections. If perhaps having Hillary Clinton run on the national stage as a woman, which she did much more in this 2016 race than in 2008, if that kind of broke this barrier in some senses, so that running in a way that really emphasizes certain aspects of your womanhood is something that is maybe a bit more acceptable now. Of course, this was also a Democratic primary. It's a different set of voters right. That you're trying to appeal to. But even so, that was an unusual thing to observe.
Go ahead, Mel.
The other thing I'll mention quickly about North Carolina is that I think it's also emblematic of what's going on nationally in that two-thirds of these female candidates, as you said, are Democrats. And that really highlights a gap that still exists. If you are a Republican woman, and there are a lot of Republican women, you still are not very frequently having a woman who is both your sort of descriptive representative who shares your gender and also your substantive representative who shares your party available to you on the ballot to vote for. And so even in a circumstance where a lot of women are running, there's a set of women who are not necessarily seeing people exactly like themselves seeking office.
Okay. Jason? You wanted to.
I think this is an interesting point about the womanness in their campaigning, especially if you compare it to the 2016 election that was one of the most hyper-masculine spaces we've seen, with all candidates appearing with guns and who's got the biggest gun they're shooting, or the NRA, where we're going now to a more gentle, what would benefit women candidates.
Okay, I want to get into that difference in terms of women running on women's issues and that perspective. Before we get to South Carolina and Karen's perspective, we've got a question from Twitter. What about Natasha Marcus's race against Jeff Tart in North Carolina's Senate District 41? Natasha's running the most flippable district in the state. It's a perfect example of what you're talking about. And the district was made closer by gerrymandering being appealed and repealed. Any thoughts about that particular local issue that we
may
be seeing?
Another thing we know is that women tend to be particularly strategic when they're deciding where to run. They tend to be a little bit more hesitant about their chances of winning, even when they're equally qualified to a male candidate. And so I think we're seeing that places where opportunities are available because of redrawing of district lines, because of open seats, these are going to be seats that are especially appealing to women. Now, they're especially appealing to male candidates as well, and so that's also why we're seeing such a loaded primary slate in a lot of these districts and races. But certainly that would help to explain why she would find that an appealing race to run in.
Okay. Karen, in your home state of South Carolina, there are no females elected to Congress. And I believe the South Carolina legislature is near the bottom in terms of female representation. With 124 seats in the state house up for grabs this year, it looks like, from what I could tell yesterday, about 45 females are running for various nominations. You study Palmetto politics, and there appears to be several female candidates running for statewide office. What are they seeing, and what's going on in South Carolina that may be similar to what we're hearing nationally and here in North Carolina?
So you're right. South Carolina has a very traditionalistic political culture, and traditionally has hugged the bottom in terms of the percentage of women in the state legislature. So 6 years ago, South Carolina was 50th in the nation, with about 12% of the state legislature being female. And at the time, the South Carolina State Senate was the only all-male legislative body in the country. So the situation has improved. It has increased to, we've now moved up to 43rd, so still in the bottom 10, with about 15%, and there are now four women in the state Senate. But at the statewide level, we have one woman who's a statewide elected official, Molly Spearman, who's the superintendent of education, and she is running for re-election, and I believe she's either unopposed or has only symbolic opposition. There are 10 candidates for governor. And of course, our current governor moved into the position from lieutenant governor when Nikki Haley became UN ambassador. So we had a women governor who has now moved on into the Trump administration. There are two women among those 10 candidates running for governor, and they are both running as outsiders, even though neither one of them actually is. So the Democratic candidate, Marguerite Willis, is the former First Lady of Florence, South Carolina. She's a very prominent attorney and has been active in Democratic politics across the board. On the Republican side, Catherine Templeton actually was an appointee twice in the Nikki Haley administration and headed two of the largest state government agencies there. And yet she self-styles positions herself as an outsider. Interestingly enough, among the male candidates, three of the leading gubernatorial candidates have already announced their lieutenant governor candidates. So for the first time since the Constitution was written in the late 19th century, the lieutenant governor and the governor will be elected together as a ticket. Previously, they were elected independently of each other. But three of the seven or eight men who are running have announced that their lieutenant governor candidates are women. So James Smith has chosen his colleague, Mandy Norrell, from the who represents the Lancaster area. Governor McMaster chose Ms. Everett, who's a key donor on the Republican side, and Phil Noble, another Democrat in the race, chose Gloria Tinubu, who is a college professor at Coastal Carolina, who is a PhD economist and served in the state legislature and was the Democratic nominee for the new 7th district when it was created after the last round of redistricting.
Was there any strategic decisions behind those?
Absolutely. Now, I think the Smith-Norrell choice had to do with just the level of respect that there is for Mandy and the fact that they're very good colleagues and friends. However, I think on McMaster's side, this was an effort to appeal to women voters. And Ms. Tinubu is African-American. So what you saw was, you know, clearly an attempt to reach both women voters and that key constituency on the Democratic side.
Okay. Kelly Dittmar at Rutgers, you had said recently that women are challenging, quote, the norms and rules of the game, unquote, when it comes to running for public office this year. We've talked a little bit about being strategic in that regard. How would you see female candidates breaking the norms and rules of the game this year?
Yeah, I think it speaks to a little bit of what Melody mentioned already in terms of how women candidates are sort of navigating or using gender on the campaign trail. And it's, you know, there's often a discussion between whether they're running as women or they're running as men. You know, are they adhering to stereotypes of femininity or masculinity, which has often been the credentials that we've used to gauge a candidate's qualifications for office? This year, I think you're seeing a mix of those things. In other words, women are running in a way that is more authentically true to themselves, so that they might be touting some stereotypically masculine credentials or expertise. There are women running who come from a background in military or CIA that are using that as a credential that's obviously applicable to their candidacy, while at the same time, and the same women candidates are talking about, you know, their own families and living lives as women in the United States. And that encompasses, you know, the experience of being a mother, of being a daughter, of being somebody who unfortunately has been vulnerable to things like sexual abuse or sexual harassment. And so when I sort of argue that they're just disrupting the norms or changing the rules of the game, my thought is that they're expanding what it looks like, what sort of behaviors are acceptable, what sort of credentials are valued in our elected leaders. And I've talked about this as a measure of success in 2018 that goes beyond whether or not women double their numbers in Congress like they did in the Year of the Woman in 1992, but instead that just by running and by running in ways that don't just adhere to stereotypical rules, they have to be man enough to do the job, that they've started to push voters to think differently about what is valued in an elected office holder. And I just say, referring back to 2016, I think Jason and Melody mentioned this, Hillary Clinton's campaign presented somewhat of an example of how you might do this. So one thing that she said in 2008 repeatedly was, you know, I'm not running as a woman, I'm strong, I'm tough, you know, 3 a.m. phone call, all of that. Very much adhering to those stereotypes of masculinity or those masculine credentials. In 2016, one of the things she said on the campaign trail was, you know, I'm not asking you to vote for me because I'm a woman. I'm asking you to vote for me on the merits. But one of those merits is that I'm a woman. And I think that recognition that your gender is not just your biology, but that your gender comes from living your life and experiencing life as a woman in the United States is a value added to somebody's candidacy because it brings with it experience and perspective that wouldn't otherwise be there. We're seeing women being willing to sort of use that credential this time around and not necessarily be fearful of the accusations that they're quote unquote playing the gender card.
I want to pick up on a point that Kelly made, Jason. You were part of a research group that looked at how women already in office can motivate other women and potentially serve as role models for future candidates. What did you find, and could Hillary Clinton's run for the presidency in 2016 impact what we are seeing this year with this wave of female candidates?
Oh, absolutely. So what we did, this was with Jeff Hardin at Notre Dame and Chrissy Latham at the University of Colorado. We looked at all state legislative elections going back to the 1970s and looked at whether the state had a high-profile female elected official or even a high-profile female candidate. So they may not have won, but we were testing what we call the role model effect. And we see a substantial impact on women breaking these barriers within states, particularly states that do move in a more progressive direction. There are states that we saw backlashes after woman governor. Kentucky comes to mind. But then on average, we're seeing about 9 more women per 100 seats if there's a high-profile woman. So this is for the state level. We've not had high-profile national women like the Hillary Clinton candidacy, but this is something we would definitely expect to have a large role model effect, that even though she didn't win, she won the popular vote, she didn't win the electoral vote, she's going to be pulling people up with her, that she's going to be empowering women from lower level offices, that if she can do that and if she can come that close to the presidency, why can't I?
And Melody, you've done some research as well in the field of candidate emergence. What factors do you see coming into play in terms of comparison to what we've seen in prior elections?
Sure, absolutely. So, as I said before, one of the big things we know matters is this recruitment process. And so to the extent that there are increasing numbers of organizations prepared to recruit women to run, to sort of encourage them in running, I think that's a really powerful thing. But thinking about this role model effect that Jason was just talking about, this can also apply to the kinds of experiences you have in your local area, the people who you interact with on a regular basis. Maybe your role model effect doesn't just help you want to run for office, but maybe it also encourages you to participate in politics in other ways. And that could therefore lay the groundwork for you to maybe get involved in your local party organization. And then you are perfectly equipped to be asked by that party to run for office in a future year. And so I expect to see that these sorts of role model effects might be influencing candidate emergence, not just in this election, but really for decades down the road, as these women have now entered these spaces where the things we know help women run, like feeling qualified, which you can get through your local political action, like being positioned to be recruited, which you get through your local political action, are now setting up a lot of women to be encouraged to run for office in the future.
Karen, it seems like we're talking about this thing, identity politics, that one's identity. How should we look at identity when it comes to politics? And we've talked a lot about the Democratic side. There was an interesting article in yesterday's Washington Post about Republican women making their run. And it was mentioned that Republicans generally, quote, have shied away from emphasizing identity and that all issues are women's issues. Is that something that's kind of an undercurrent of what we're seeing in this year's campaigns?
Absolutely. And I think that some of what we've already heard harkens to that. You know, when women talk about running as women or their experiences as women, what I think is new, though, is that if we see Republican women embracing their gender identity and using that as well, it is a bit of a breakthrough. And whenever I teach this, I talk about the fact that there are certain public policies that actually have a disproportionate impact, even though I certainly believe all public policies affect men and women. They can, in fact, affect them differently. And it is not even just that small number of public policies that we might consider women's issues, like reproduction, childcare, education, that there could be something like Social Security, for example.
We'll pick up on that. This is Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE in Hickory. I'm Michael Bitzer, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking about the Year of the Woman in our national, state, and even local politics with Dr. Jason Wendett of UNC Charlotte, Dr. Kelly Dittmar of Rutgers University, Dr. Melody Crowder-Meyer of Davidson College, and I unfortunately had to cut off Dr. Karen Kodrowski of Winthrop University. You had made the point about identity, and it's becoming such a breakthrough kind of moment. I want you to finish your thought, but why has identity become such a breakthrough event in this particular year's elections and politics?
Well, I think part is that if it works, right, strategic political actors will use strategies that work in part. But we also see that identity politics, even if it is not labeled as such or if it is not consciously thought of, when we look at women once they are elected to office, that irrespective of their ideology, that women redefine the nature of the public agenda, and that women will bring forward issues and make them the business of government that otherwise might have been ignored. And we see this time and time again. Even if they vote along with their parties, the government ends up talking about a wider range of issues when there are more women in government.
Okay. Melody, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah. So I think that this is a moment where we're recognizing that identities of all sorts are influential in how people experience their lives and also, therefore, in how they engage in politics. So not only is there identity as a woman or identity as a person of color, there's also white identity, which we've certainly seen a lot of discussion of, or rural identity, which there's been some research on and ample discussions in the media about. So I think this idea of a focus on identity politics is really saying that we are recognizing that your lived experiences, whatever they are, whatever your race, whatever your geographic place, whatever your gender, are part of how you engage in politics. The question, though, is how these are then going to be accepted by the kinds of political actors who are important for supporting your campaign financially, for supporting your campaign with voter lists and volunteers and people to go out door knocking and asking people to run. And here's where I think the Republican and Democratic parties continue to have a really significant and important difference. I have a paper with Rosalind Cooperman that's coming out this fall that basically identifies a party culture in the Democratic Party and a party culture in the Republican Party that have been persistent since the 1980s and before. In the Democratic Party, this culture is still very supportive of representing yourself as a person with an identity and sort of validating your political action because of that identity. So you are bringing something to the table because of your identity. You have a group of people who you are seeking to represent because of that identity, and you have a seat at the table in the party with that identity. And we find this looking at Democratic donors, so donors to congressional campaign committees, as well as to PACs supporting particular types of groups. They tend to be motivated to donate by the identities of the candidates who are running, as well as many other things. There's a substantive component to this. It's about the policies that these candidates will support. But talking about identity is sort of permitted. On the Republican side, we see something just dramatically different. Even Republican congressional donors who gave money through so-called women's PACs. So there are groups on both the Democratic and Republican side who are organized to try to support female candidates. Even Republican donors who gave money through these women's PACs are still unwilling to say that they are motivated by candidate gender, by positions on gender or racial issues when they are giving their campaign contributions. And so even among individuals who have sort of progressive values themselves in the Republican Party, who are giving money through these methods in the Republican Party, they still decline to prioritize identity, to sort of admit that identity is a part of their decision making. And I think that can help explain some of what we're seeing even this year in elections. If you look at primary elections, where you've got Republican donors who might be playing an important role, Democratic donors who are playing an important role, Democratic women are winning and losing at about equal rates. So in the Senate, about half of the primaries that have happened, Democratic women have won that they ran in or have lost. In the House, it's the same. 64 lost their primaries, 63 won their primaries. You see this in gubernatorial races as well. On the Republican side, Republican women are losing their primaries. All seven gubernatorial Republican candidates who are women lost their primaries. Only 11 Republican women in the House won their primaries compared to 22 who lost. Only one Republican woman won her Senate primary compared to four who lost. And so in this earlier time period, when they're relying on people within the parties to sort of bolster their candidacies, Republican and Democratic women are getting very different levels of support. And I think that these underlying party cultures are going to be something we'll be grappling with for a very long time.
Jason, we
can I jump in there?
Yeah, go ahead, Kelly.
Yeah, I just want to I think we have to be careful when we talk about identity and not play into the narrative that identity only means women and minorities. And I think, you know, Melody mentioned this, that whiteness is an identity. Being a man is an identity. And Donald Trump, of all candidates in recent times is probably the greatest purveyor of identity politics, in that his appeals were primarily on race and gender. The masculinity that he performed on the campaign trail, the way in which he used race and sort of baited race throughout the campaign, was very much identity politics. So part of what Melody's capturing, I think, as well, is, yes, an unwillingness to say that's what it is or to recognize that's what it is. But identity is not new to politics. Identity politics, as we're talking about them, are not new at all. In fact, identity, especially in terms of gender and race, have been a key motivator in American politics for centuries. And so I think we have to put this year and the focus on women and the focus on diversity of candidates when we talk about race and ethnicity into a broader discussion about identity politics, which does include whiteness and masculinity that has really been the trends or the ways in which we've engaged in identity politics in the past.
Well, one of the interesting points that I came across yesterday in preparing for the show, and Jason, I want to direct this to you. We've got a notable candidate in the state of Georgia for the first female African-American claiming the Democratic Party's nominations for their governorship. Stacey Abrams' strategy, in the words of the New York Times, who wrote about her yesterday, is to not play it safe in terms of her campaign. How do you think her candidacy will play out in a southern state that Donald Trump won by 5 points over Hillary Clinton, but he only won with 50% of the vote? Will her candidacy and the way her campaign evolves over the next coming months, will that send a signal also about this year's politics?
Yeah. Political scientists are fantastic at predicting outcomes of elections.
We'll put that for another show.
But when I look at this Georgia race, I'm looking at comparisons in Georgia this year to comparisons of North Carolina in 2008 with Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be on-the-ground troops. It's going to be first-time voters. It's going to be getting the minority vote out and energizing that base. And I think she does this, right? She's very... this is who I am. She's not going to walk a party line. She doesn't care who she upsets. I think this is going to bode well. And Georgia has a history of outsider politics with people like Zell Miller or even Jimmy Carter running for governor as the peanut farmer. So this could bode well for Democrats in Georgia, especially if they can get turnout up.
Melanie. Yeah, just piggybacking on Jason's comment there, one of the things we know is that women don't particularly vote for women. People of color don't particularly vote for people of color. It's not the case that voter behavior tends to be motivated by the candidates' descriptive characteristics, their gender, their race, and things like that. However, we do know that Black voters tend to vote Democratic, which she is a running as a Democrat. And so I think it's not about turning out voters because they are changing their minds about who they want to vote for because of that candidate's identity. But rather, it's about having someone who will actually go and try to motivate voters who maybe haven't turned out before, which means they're harder to turn out. You have to get them registered. You have to make sure they know where their polling place is. Really, it's about sort of energizing voters who maybe haven't been activated before, but who would have voted for a candidate from that party regardless of their particular identity characteristics.
Karen.
I just wanted to make explicit something that I think Jason implied, which is that we cannot separate this discussion of women as candidates and elected officials separated from normal politics, right? So this is a midterm election where voter turnout is likely to be about 20 points less than it is in a presidential election. And for any candidate to get elected, male or female, it's going to be very much a game of voter turnout. Can you get your voters to turn out at the polls in September? In large enough numbers to get me elected. And then the same thing goes with, fundraising and capturing voter interest, which is much more difficult in a midterm election than it is in a presidential.
Is there a difference between how women prepare strategy and do the campaign logistics and the fundraising versus the way male candidates do, or is there a comparability between the two?
I think that they're probably employing a lot of the same political consultants, and that their strategy is going to be much the same. Okay. You know, their messaging might be slightly different, but the strategy will be the
okay.
same.
Okay, Jason.
And I would...
Yep. Oh. Kelly, go ahead.
I would just add one other thing. I mean, there is a distinction as well for women of color in this particular context. One thing, we've done work with Higher Heights for America, which is an organization trying to increase Black women's political participation. Of course, they're heavily involved in Stacey Abrams' race. And there are two particular hurdles that face women of color, Black women in particular, one being the perception that they just can't win a statewide race, right? So parties and partisans have this perception. And so you have to overcome the idea that, well, they can only win in majority-minority areas, which has been predominantly where we've seen success for Black women and women of color more broadly. So in that way, does Stacey Abrams, as well as Michelle Lujan Grisham and Lupe Valdez, another women of color who are running this cycle, Paulette Jordan, do they fare better statewide and therefore challenge those conceptions of who can win? And secondly, there is a difference in the sort of financial networks and financial resources that women of color have access to. And so I think Karen's right that you generally are going to approach this the same way. But I do think when it comes to funding, there's an additional need to boost those networks and outreach beyond the state, which can be, as we all know, a negative and a positive, right? Mm-hmm. So Stacey Abrams is going to get a lot of money from outside of Georgia, but her opponents are going to use that against her. And so it's something that she's going to face that might be a little bit different than other candidates who are running statewide.
Jason, you wanted to...
Yeah, and we also have to remember that this is midterm elections with few exceptions also are backlash against the party in power.
Okay.
So this is going to be something that also helps the Democratic candidates. It could be disillusioned Republican voters staying home. It could be disillusionment with President Trump. It could be candidates bring increasing turnout. But the end party of the presidency usually loses lots of seats and governorships in midterm election years, especially after the first term of the president.
Okay. In the last couple of minutes of our show, I want to get to moving beyond if they're running and if they actually get elected and what the role of women are in terms of being in elective office. I mentioned at the top of the show, Kelly, that you have a book coming out entitled A Seat at the Table about what motivates women in Congress and their legislative priorities and behavior. Kelly, what do women bring to elective office that may be different from what men bring?
I think there's a significant scholarship on this that looks at differences in priorities on issues that pertain, that are most important to women. So things we've typically called women's issues, education, equal pay, things like that. And that's true. Some of the women, we interviewed 83 of the women in the 114th Congress, and we asked them, you know, what difference does it make that you're there? And some of them did point to those issues, the issues that they brought to the fore. But they also said, you know, it goes beyond, quote unquote, women's issues. We bring a perspective and insights onto all sorts of issues, whether it be criminal justice or immigration, because we come at this from a different perspective than our male counterparts. Another thing that they mentioned to us that was really across the board. So Republican, Democrat, Senator, House member, almost to a T, they all said to us, we came here to get things done. And so that they had a results-oriented perspective on doing the job of being a congresswoman or a legislator, that they focused on achievement over ego. And they felt that for their male counterparts, that balance was a little bit different. And so I think that feeds into what we've seen in the public narrative about women being more likely to compromise or being more collaborative. And while partisanship obviously prevents that from happening in a lot of cases, these women are partisan beings just like their male counterparts. But when there are those opportunities for collaboration, they see it as a means to an end of results, right? It's not just because they're kumbaya, it's because they actually are there to get policy done. And so I think that those are some of the big takeaways that we heard from the women. And we also heard specifically from women coming from diverse racial and ethnic backgrounds that having their particular experiences were important, as well as being at the table to be role models, as we talked about earlier, for young women and men to see that public leadership can look like them.
We're getting close to the end of the show. I want to end with a question for all folks and about 20 seconds for a response from everybody. Dante Cheney, in writing for NBC News, said, but even if most of these female nominees don't win in November, the early results suggest there may be something more seismic going on with gender in politics in 2018. Jason, do you see something seismic going on?
Yep. Motivation, more candidates, people we wouldn't expect running for office. It's going to be a big deal.
Okay. Melody?
Absolutely. Once you recast who deserves a seat at the table, who is capable of ruling, that has the potential to change how society sees men and women and their relationships and positions more broadly.
Okay. Karen?
Yes. And it is not only because of women running for office. It is because of the issues that have been placed on the table. Sexual harassment, sexual assault, and sexism.
Okay.
Sex discrimination.
And we'll give the last word to Kelly.
And I would say, yeah, women can change the credentials, what we view as appropriate and necessary to be an effective legislator.
That was Dr. Kelly Dittmar from Rutgers University joining us, also with Dr. Jason Wendett of UNC Charlotte, Dr. Melody Crowder-Meyer of Davidson College, and Dr. Karen Kodrowski of Winthrop University. Thank you all very much for the hour.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.